Hey there, friends. Jay Revel here. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Mid-Am Crisis. I am awfully pleased to bring you another episode that I think you're going to really enjoy. Today's guest is none other than my friend Alan Shipnuck, senior writer at golf.com. Alan is one of the best golf writers in the business. He's been in it for probably going on a quarter century now. Sort of the child prodigy at Sports Illustrated, and now, again, one of the great voices in the game of golf. We caught up as he was coming off covering a Masters unlike any other. He was on the ground in Augusta for that rare November Masters we all just had the opportunity to enjoy. So certainly we talked about that. We talked about the evolution of the game of golf, Dustin Johnson's incredible run he's been on. And, of course, we dove into where he lives in the world, which is one of my favorite places, Carmel, California, the Monterey Peninsula. Talked a little bit about that and also dove into the future of golf journalism. It was a great conversation. I was so just blessed to have Alan on the phone for a little bit and catch up. He's been a great friend to me, someone who has helped me get some of my words published over the last couple of years. And just an all-around great guy. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. I think you're going to like it. As always, if you're enjoying the show, I hope you will leave us a review on your favorite listening channel. Tell your friends about it. And be sure to hit that subscribe button. It's been fun watching the numbers climb recently. I'm getting a lot of great feedback from people. And again, as long as people keep digging the show, I'll keep churning them out. I'm having a lot of fun with it, having some great conversations with people, and I'm enjoying the feedback I'm getting, and of course, suggestions for people that I should bring on the show. So if you ever have any feedback or thoughts, hit me up. I love to hear from you, and maybe you can be a guest on an episode in the not-too-distant future. Thanks again for listening. I appreciate it as always. I'll leave you with one final selfless plug. If you're looking for the perfect stocking stuffer as we get into the holiday season for the golfer in your life, I hope you'll give my book, The 9 Virtues of Golf, a look. It's available on Amazon. And if you want a custom signed version of the book, just drop me a note. I'd love to send you one and we can personalize it and make it something that's a unique golf gift for the people you know who love the game. Anywho, without further ado, here's my conversation with Alan Shipnuck. Thanks for listening as always. Looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Alan.
Hey, Jay, how's it going?
It's going well, man. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm good. I'm still recovering from Augusta, but that was quite an experience, and just no rest for the weary. You know, the PGA Tour season marches on and everything else. So, but life is good. I can't complain.
Well, there's certainly worse things you could have to recover from, I suppose. But a few days in the good graces of the Green Jackets is a nice thing to have to come back from.
Yeah, it was such an interesting experience. It's actually my 25th Masters, and so I've been lucky to see a lot of changes around that place and see the course play a lot of different ways. And of course, we know this was a highly unusual one. The best part was the spectating, because at every other, you know, professional golf event, we're blessed to get inside the ropes, and you can the teeming masses. It's really necessary if you're gonna try and observe what's happening out there and bring a sense of intimacy to your reporting. And Augusta, they don't let you inside the ropes. And so it's not easy to see and feel connected to what's happening just from the tournament action standpoint. And so to be out there, not only with no fans, but they didn't even have ropes. They just painted some lines on the ground where to stand. And, you know, you never felt so connected to the shots. I mean, just incredible views, and taking away the grandstands and the clutter and the people, just the way Augusta National looked different. You know, you could, when you were on 13 fairway, you could see not only 14 tee, but you could see 15 fairway, and all that stuff's hidden usually by people and infrastructure, and a lot of little glimpses like that. Well, just it made the course feel smaller, and it made the experience so different. So that it was really a special thing to get a master's all to ourselves. You know, the lucky few who were there, and of course, the not having the crowds was you missed out electricity and the roars so there was you know, coronavirus giveth and taketh away, but it was certainly a unique experience, and I'm really happy I got to be there.
I had a chance last year to go to the inaugural Women's AM and do some reporting up there, and I didn't get a hard figure, but the great intel I was getting from the lovely ladies working the food and beer line was that they thought it was somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 people that they let in, and it was crazy, man. I mean, it was like being able to get into like a it was like it felt like a preview party for the Masters. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I mean, we could get right up on the action on every shot. I watched the entire duel between Kupcho and Fossey coming down the back nine. I didn't miss a single shot. Never had a crowd around me. It was truly remarkable, and that's what it made me think of when I was watching, kind of watching from afar. But it had to have been pretty surreal, I would imagine. I enjoyed the piece you wrote about kind of that whole vibe. That was pretty cool, really intimate.
Yeah, and I think that's a preview of what's going to happen in 2021. I mean, talking to some green jackets on the grounds. Of course, if there's some mega breakthrough on the vaccine front and it's produced and distributed in numbers that seem unlikely, but forecasting ahead, I mean, I think they're probably going to let 3,000 or 5,000 fans on the grounds. They'll be tested every day, and
Wow.
there'll be some sense of a gallery. It won't be like it usually is, but I think enough to give some ambiance, and that'd be enough to justify bringing back the par three tournament, because that was kind of the reason they did it. It's like, without fans, what's the point? And so I think that's the plan, because for the reporters that were covering this Masters, I mean, we all had to get tested, and it couldn't have been easier. You went through a gate at kind of the fringe of the Augusta National property, drive through, violated by a Q-tip, and then 15 minutes later we had our results, and they were sort of beamed into the master computer, where we'd swipe our credential, they would know that we passed and we were in. So I mean, Augusta has the resources and technology to make it work, so I think there will be fans, but of course the way the virus numbers are going now and heading into winter, if things get totally out of control, that could change. But right now they're kind of gearing up to have kind of an experience like you had at the Women's Amateur. And again, that would be the greatest Masters ticket ever for the general
Oh,
public if you can get in next year.
yeah, no kidding. Yeah, those will come with a hefty price tag for the secondary market, which
Oh,
people
yeah.
like to pretend doesn't exist. But I have to imagine that's probably the nicest COVID testing facility in America you probably went through.
Yeah, well, it's actually, I mean, I've now been tested 4 times. I'm helping to keep our national infection rate down. But when I covered the Dinosaur, it was same thing. This one was, it was off campus. But yeah, the drive-through is easy. You just pull up, you roll your window down, they do the swab, and you drive away. So, and again, we're talking 4 or 5 months from now, they'll even probably more advances, and they'll be even more seamless. So it's an interesting mind experiment just to think about what the Masters would be like with limited fans, but it would certainly help. Even with the 300 people or whoever were there, I mean, everyone clusters in obvious spots. You know, there's one tee, there's back of two green, back of seven green, 10 tee, obviously Amen corner, 15 green slash 16 tee, and then of course behind 18. And so even if you only had 3,000 people, it would look good, because all 3,000 people are going to be in kind of similar spots on Sundays as the action progresses.
What was the vibe like? Obviously, probably a little different because DJ was kept climbing ahead. But coming down that stretch on Sunday, you started to see a little bit more of the limited crowd that was there congregating around the final group. I mean, what was that scene like?
Well, it was interesting. First of all, there was green jackets in their green jackets, and the guys who had sort of official tournament roles were wearing their blazers, the club members. And during tournament week, traditionally every member is turned out in their jacket, but they said for this year that wasn't necessary because the tradition began, as the story goes, in the first few Masters. Clifford Roberts wanted the members to be able to advise the fans on how to get around or if they had questions. Sorry, that's my dog Monty. And it was to help the spectators. And but with no spectators, they told the members they didn't have to wear their jackets. So you had Peyton Manning just out there in a windbreaker, and so that was kind of funny to some of these people. Roger Goodell. I mean, some of them are pretty visible even without the jacket. But that was kind of a parlor game throughout the week, is just keeping on tabs on who the members were and what they were doing. But yeah, it was subdued because the reporters are somewhat impartial. We're not going to be out there cheering. But it was kind of neat. A lot of players wandered down because they could. In the past, it's such a crush of humanity around 18. But I saw probably 10 or 12 players who walked down just to kind of see DJ finish and be there to soak in the scene. So that was kind of neat. And I think someone asked me in the wake of it, because of the way the course played, and not only the low scores, but you could see parts, patches where it wasn't good turf and the tee boxes were beat up, and which I loved, by the way, because it actually looked like a real golf course instead of Disneyland. It was like, oh, the horror. There's some divot holes, and there's it's what a golf course looks like when golfers play it. So I thought that was cool. But so, did the Green Jackets regret it? And my answer to that is, if Cam Smith had won, they might have. But you had the number one player in the world, really establishing himself as a player for the ages, and the fact that Dustin won it in such convincing fashion really, I think, elevates the importance of this Masters. And the winning score is irrelevant. I mean, any golf course with soft greens, these guys are going to tear apart, and that's just how it is. But I thought, it was too bad that it rained so much on Thursday morning, and they could never get any fire back in the golf course. But there's been plenty of April Masters where the course is compromised by weather. So I think in the end, the players were deeply grateful. They got to compete for a green jacket. It was great for sports fans. The digital offerings that, being able to watch every single shot was phenomenal. And so I don't think there's any regret. I mean, I think it was the best they could do under the circumstances. They got an incredible winner, and on to the next one. So there was a sense of pride, to answer your question. I mean, you could feel it from the club. Like, we did it. We pulled it off. We got a great winner. It was a crazy year, but we gave back in the way that we could, and now we're just going to march forward.
Yeah, I had a similar feeling just as a fan, in that, I kind of felt grateful. The Green Jackets get a lot of criticism, through the years. Although, the Riddler seems to be doing a phenomenal job of really change. I mean, truthfully changing the perception of the club. I think these, initiatives that he keeps laying out year after year are pretty damn cool. And, I just felt like, I was like, they didn't have to do it. But they did. And I felt like we all got rewarded to see, to your point, it was a refreshing take of Augusta. It felt like, this is probably a stretch, but it felt a little more relatable. Because we're all having to go through, certain modifications, just, whether it's at work or at home or whatever, everybody's going through changes. And even, these folks who seemingly can be, the problems of the world don't seem to affect them sometimes, are being affected by it. I just found the whole thing to be a delight. It was nice to watch. It was especially the week after the election with all this craziness that's been going on, for so long. It was like, man, we get to check out and watch the Masters for 4 days. Sign me up. Can we do it every November? I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think anyone would mind if they did two masters a year. I mean, maybe Fred really, that could be his legacy. He doubled our pleasure. Yeah, it's crazy to think we're going to do it again in less than 5 months now. So then it'll be really neat if they could get a firm, fast, fiery golf course, and it would play a totally different manner. And I mean, Dustin's going to be a huge favorite. I would love to see him win it. He doesn't need to validate this one, but it would be cool for his legacy to if he could get one more in more traditional setting.
I think the odds of him winning more went up considerably after that win. I feel like you could see it. He kind of had this. I just sort of seems like the pressure is maybe off of him now. I mean, it was the perfect kind of Masters for him to win and then maybe propel him to more. It just felt like it was a very DJ style. It was just perfect for him, you know?
I agree. And it's time to now start talking about what a historic run the guy is on. I mean, he's in a 4 or 5 year stretch here of some of the best golf's ever been played. And Oakmont is the ultimate US Open venue. He conquered that. He's now won a Masters. I can't wait to see what he does from here, because he might be playing at a higher level than any human being has ever played when you consider the way the game has evolved, the equipment, the training. I know it sounds crazy to think that way, but what he's doing to the golf ball, the utter control he has of it, and his efficiency. I mean, if you took the 2000 Tiger Woods with his equipment, and you put him against the 2020 Dustin Johnson, that'd be a hell of a battle. Because they're playing slightly different games now, and that's how it is in every sport. I mean, we don't want to acknowledge it in golf; it's become kind of this taboo subject. But in every sport, athletes get better, bigger, faster, stronger, more efficient. And golf is in the middle of kind of another revolution. And Dustin's been in the vanguard, and he's just playing at an incredibly high level. And So some of his follies in the majors have obscured that, I think, to some degree. But if he can go on a run here and start picking them off with more frequency, I think he'll be recognized belatedly for what he's doing, because it's really next level golf that he's playing.
Yeah, I think that's right. You talked about kind of the revolutions, right? I mean, so when Tiger hit his peak, 2000, 2001, that was a revolution, and the response from Augusta was tighter, longer, with other implements put in place. What do you think they end up doing? Because I feel like the ball is actually, no pun intended, but the ball is in their court. If anyone acts, it will be them, because they have the unique ability or the unique position to try and protect this, legendary golf course. What do you think they do in the next few years as far as equipment, technology, ball, all that stuff goes?
It's really not their fight. I mean, we already have governing bodies whose mandate is to regulate equipment, and it's not fair to make Augusta do it. I mean, if they introduce a Masters ball just for that 1 week, it makes the whole thing a farce. I mean, it'd be like raising the rims to 11 feet for just the NBA Finals. It's the same game, but it's different. I mean, guys have spent years or decades optimizing their equipment and their swing and their launch condition, and also they have to relearn everything to play the most important tournament. It's not fair to the players. It's not fair to the Masters. I mean, what they venerate around there is tradition and continuity and history. They don't want to have their entire tournament overshadowed by a golf ball, and so I think the last thing they want to do is have to go down this road. But I think they can apply a lot of pressure to the USGA and the RNA. It's their job to, of course, I mean, they've been asleep at the wheel for 2 decades now, so I'm sure the Green Jackets are frustrated, but You know, I think they could keep making changes to the course. I mean, if you move the 13 tee box just 5 yards to the left, that drive becomes so much more difficult. I think they can keep making subtle changes like that. I mean, bunkers can be moved, tee boxes can be adjusted. It's ridiculous that it has to be done over and over again, and it's pathetic, but it's still a better solution than coming up with a Masters ball, which would be, again, it would overshadow the entire tournament. And you would think that with everything that's happened this year, especially with Matt Wolf and obviously Bryson DeChambeau, that the USGA is finally going to act. And it doesn't have to be the ball per se. I mean, I've been saying for a while now, a simple fix would be just make the maximum club head size for a driver or any wood, like cut it in half, make it 230 CCs, like kind of like the drivers that we grew up using. Because you remember, it used to be a risk to hit driver because I mean, it was the penalty was so high for a miss hit. And now it's the easiest club to hit. I mean, these guys can swing as hard as they want. The sweet spot's so gigantic. And so if you made the club head that much smaller, the penalty becomes much steeper for a bad swing. It forces guys to ease off the gas just a little bit, but you're still rewarded. If you absolutely flush it, it's still going to go really far. And I mean, hitting it long and straight is a skill and a talent that should be rewarded. But it's come too cheap now. And so, you know, there's various solutions that would be, because if you do a throttle back ball and all of a sudden Bryson's driving at 270, the game, you lose the wow factor because I can drive at 270. And so, you know, and we're drawn to professional athletes because they can do things that we can't. And that's what makes spectating fun. And so bifurcation is problematic. I mean, from the standpoint, it's an entertainment product. And if the guys start hitting it short, you lose a lot of the entertainment value. Even though I love the classic courses and I want to protect them, we just have to find a better balance. So, you know, I would start with the club head size and see if that makes a material difference. I believe it would.
One of the things I wonder about too that could be a tweak is, the drivers don't have grooves anymore. They're just a solid, metal face. And I wonder if one of, again, one of those sort of weird little tweaks you might can make is, okay, every club other than the putter has to have grooves on it. It puts more spin on the ball. And I think, to your point is it, what it sort of feels like to me that we've hit a point where even though these guys are incredibly talented and obviously, just world-class athletes and their skill sets are just amazingly impressive, I think that the equipment diminishes their ability to show off their skills. You know what I mean? Like I feel like we fantasize about, watching Seve work a ball around a golf course because it truly was this magical, thing to behold. Bubba's kind of one of the last people that really works the ball, and that to me was always a showcase of skill that these guys could do that. And now it's, when you just kind of hit it straight, hit it far, hit it high, hit it online, it feels like it doesn't require as much. And I think, you talk about kind of the way DJ is playing these days, he is picking these golf courses apart, and he's doing it in a way that is, really cool to see and watch. And I mean, he is a generational talent. But I think it also makes one of those scenarios where it's harder to notice the difference between good and great because of the equipment.
Well, without a doubt. And I mean, one of the things that ended Seve Ballesteros' run was a 60-degree wedge because his biggest advantage was in the short game and the things he could do with the old wedge. And all of a sudden, everyone else had some of the shots that only he had. And it's just like, you know, what Greg Norman and Tiger Woods' advantage was, they could drive it so long, but equipment brought everyone else closer to them. And it's the same with Dustin. I mean, if the equipment gets throttled back, his advantage will grow because he hits it so flush, and that's not going to change. But it's the guys who are getting away with the mediocre strikes because they have so much technology in their hands. Instead of being on the green 40 feet away, now they're in the creek or they're short sighted in the bunker. Dustin's going to hit every fairway and every green no matter what you give him. But it's the other guys who are going to struggle. So, the best players would be even more dominant.
I feel like one of the
Yeah.
things we are almost robbed of because of the technology today is we don't our measure of the generational player, quote unquote, has to be different. And DJ is kind of the poster child of this, and maybe even Rory to some extent. But because the technology has equalized so much of the talent, I don't know if you'll ever see anybody hit 9, 10 majors again. I mean, it feels like the it's so much harder for them to separate themselves on a level that was once a possibility. I mean, nowadays it feels like if you get to that 4, 5, 6 number, you've really done something.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's kind of what makes DJ's, 5-year run now even more incredible. He just needs a few more major championships to validate it. But it's never been harder to separate yourself. And, part of what ended Seve Ballesteros' reign was the advent of the 60-degree wedge, where all of a sudden every other player could do what around the greens, what only Seve could. And, Norman and Tiger, they lost a big advantage when the Big Bertha and other drivers like that kind of changed the game because they were so long with the old drivers, and everyone else started to catch up. And you see that it's happened at various points in golf history. But you're right, the depth of talent, the fact that everyone is now fully optimized, not only their equipment but their bodies, their minds. I mean, it's never been harder to break away. And so when you see a guy like Dustin do what he's done, you have to really understand it in the context of how hard it is.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable to think about what he's doing. So, shifting gears a little bit, you have the incredible blessing of living in probably my favorite little nook of the world, out on the Monterey Peninsula. What's for those of us who just have to get to visit every now and then, what's life like out there? And why can't we all enjoy it?
Well, it is a wonderful place to live. I grew up in Salinas, a little bit to the east, famously the home of John Steinbeck. And so I very jokingly refer to myself as the second best writer to come out of Salinas, but there's quite a big gap between one and two. Yeah, it is really wonderful. I mean, the climate's great. The neat thing about the area is it's small town living, but the whole world comes to you. We have International Film Festival and Jazz Festival and biggest, car auction in the world, and you just keep going down the list. I mean, there's a lot of culture. There's a lot of interesting people coming and going. But we live out in Carmel Valley. We don't even lock our doors at night, and it's very pastoral. And so it is nice. And of course, you have San Francisco is only a couple hours away. You have Silicon Valley and all the resources and brain power. That's an hour away. Big Sur, just a little bit to the south, is one of the most wondrous places to explore on the planet. So it's really special, and I feel very blessed. And of course, there's a lot of great golf. And not only just to play, but also to cover. I get three tournaments a year. There's the Crosby Clambake, the Senior Tour comes through. And then right now, actually, this week is the Pebble Beach Invitational, which is kind of a smaller off-season event. But a lot of pros come out as a working vacation, and you can get stuff done. So it's nice to have 3 weeks a year where I can work without having to, really leave home.
For those who live out there, obviously, when I've taken trips out there, you get to play tacky tourist and jump around some of the great courses. What's the local golf scene like? For people like yourself who are playing regularly out there, what's that world feel like?
Well, it's same as like when I lived in New York City. It slows down because when you're visiting, you're trying to cram so much in, and you have this list of things you have to do and places you have to get to. But when you're here, you can just enjoy it, and you start to, you find the places that are off the beaten path and that are more kind of locals joints as opposed to tourists. And so yeah, it's a special place. I mean, my family, we'd been living in town in Carmel by the Sea, and just moved out to Carmel Valley, kind of deep into the valley this summer. And so now it's hidden swimming holes in the river, and it's hiking in the hills, and there's all the sorts of great wineries out here, and some really neat little restaurants. And so it's a whole universe unto itself, which is only 18 minutes from downtown Carmel. So I've kind of been doing my own exploring and have really loved it. And so yeah, it is just a special place. I mean, if you're going on a buddy's trip, Bandon is still probably the greatest destination in America. But if you're going with a romantic partner or maybe a few different couples, I mean, you can't beat this area because there's just the food and wine and the strolling, the shopping, the natural beauty you can explore without a golf club in your hand. It's pretty unparalleled.
My wife and I have basically replicated the same trip, with not too many variations, a couple of times now. We stay down at Clint's place at the Mission Ranch.
Yeah, it's great.
Love it. Super laid back. We always take a day trip down to Big Sur and eat down there at what's it, Nepenthe? How do you say
Yeah,
that?
Nepenthe,
Yeah,
yeah.
fabulous. I always sneak around a golf in at least one, maybe two if I'm lucky. And a day trip out to the valley is so cool. Like you said, you got the wineries out there. And I mean I just love it. It's such a cool scene. It feels like the most laid back place on earth. And yeah, again, on the golf front, I mean I don't know if there's anywhere with a better vibe. I have yet to pull the Bandon trip off yet, but particularly again with the missus in tow, that's about as good as you can draw up for a trip.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a couple spots you can stand in Pebble Beach where you can see, four top 100 courses. You can see Cypress. You can like if you're on say the third tee at Spyglass, you can see Cypress, Spyglass, the short course, and the dunes, and at Monterey Peninsula the Country Club. So, and then of course the granddaddy of them all is around the corner at Pebble Beach. So there's it's just the incredible proximity of the courses, and it's really a shame. I mean, I've been one of my pet peeves in golf is the exclusivity of some of these great courses. I feel like there should be, it's like Cypress Point to me is like Yosemite. It should be a national treasure, and I wish more people would get to play it. Same with the courses at Monterey Peninsula Country Club. I mean, you come and you play Pebble Beach and Spyglass Hill and Paso Tiempo. I mean, that's a hell of a trip, but if you could play Cypress and you could play both courses at Monterey, it's like maybe the greatest trip on the planet. So I wish there was more access, but it's just the world we live in. But they are all really, incredible experiences.
I had the pleasure of playing Monterey Peninsula Shore Course a few years ago on one of our trips. Teed off at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I think we were there in about October, so it was like right before daylight savings crapped out. I had to place myself. It was unbelievable. It was a truly remarkable experience. And then when you juxtapose that with Pebble, where obviously Pebble is one of the great days you're ever going to spend on a golf course. But I mean, it's 6 hours and you're waiting on almost every shot, and you're obviously footing a big bill. But I mean, to be able to play out on the private side where I pretty much had that unbelievable oceanic experience all to my, I mean, literally there was no one on the golf course. It was like a Tuesday in October and late afternoon. It was just me and the caddy. We had the whole place to ourselves, and it was one of the most remarkable afternoons I've ever had. So it is just strange, kind of mix out there with the public and private. But Cypress is my
great white buffalo. It's so excruciating because you can get so close to it. You know, it's not like, you know, at Augusta, you can drive by the gate, you know, but there's nothing really you can see as a passerby. But out there, you literally can, you know, you can make a run for it if you wanted to. You know, you could go out there, and I don't know how long you'll last, but
yeah. Well, when I was in college, me and some friends went out with glow in the dark balls and played 15 and 16. So, I'm not saying that your listeners should do the same thing, but it's been done. And yeah, it's true. There's that little turnout at Fan Shell Beach. You know, you can see 12, 13, and 14, which is one of the greatest stretchers of par fours on the planet. And then you can just, if you kind of crane your neck and get a little glimpse of 15T. Of course, then we know what's around the corner. So yeah, it's, you're right. You literally drive through Cypress Point. I mean, you have to, if you're playing, you walk off 14 green, you have to cross 17 mile drive to get over to 15T. So it's, it is right there. It's so tantalizing. And, you know, it's anecdotally, a lot of the great private clubs during the time of coronavirus have been letting outside play in, because they're just, a lot of these old places actually rely on the guest play to help balance the books. If you're in the area, you have a local person who could write a letter, it never hurts to try. I mean, I don't want to say too much more, 'cause I don't want to get myself in trouble, but I've been hearing stories lately about a lot of clubs that are actually, you know, accommodating with, if you make the right introduction and you send a polite letter and you're willing to pay the guest fee, which is steep. So I don't know. It's I know Cypress is actually easier to get on than probably any other course of its caliber, in that they do unaccompanied guest play. So a member can just call in and get a foursome out. And you got to go early. You have to play between 7 and 8 a.m., which is kind of pure anyway. But, you know, they're not doing that at Augusta National or Pine Valley or places like that. I mean, the member has to be on site. So Cypress has always been a little more attainable, you know, if you move in certain circles in the golf world. But it does bum me out. I mean, I wish every golfer could play at once. And when I win the lottery and I build my Abigail Hance or whomever build me like my own golf course, I'm going to set aside a couple days a week for everyone to play it, because it's really a drag. You know, Golf Magazine just put out its top 100 list, and it's fun to look at. You know, it's like looking at Playboy. You know, it's all a fantasy, right? We all need our own escapes, but you know, for the average reader, you know, how many courses they have access to? It's such a small number. You can play the banded courses. You can save up for a year and maybe play Pebble and this and that. But the whole exercise to me is a little pointless when it's a tiny tribe of golfers who can really discuss the merits of Fisher's Island versus Cypress Point versus Oakmont versus Crystal Downs. You know, you and I are lucky. We get to play some of these courses, but everyone else is just on the outside looking in. And I'm feeling more and more like those top 100 lists are kind of a relic from a different era.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, you think about, you know, this moment that golf is having right now, right? Where, you know, golf is a sport that doesn't catch moments all that often. You know, they kind of come every, you know, maybe 20 years. And we're in one right now, and it's a very weird, you know, batch of circumstances that has created it. But imagine if all these people who are coming back to the game, finding, you know, reasons to love golf again, finding time probably more than anything, had an opportunity to go and experience the very best of American golf during this time while their interest is at a peak. It could fundamentally, you know, change the outlook for the game for a long time. But it's just really, to your point, it's really not an option. And that is unfortunate. Although I think we have more great golf publicly available now than we maybe ever have. So there's a lot of good there too.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, I was just at Bandon not too long ago, and I mean, it's incredible, and their prices are very fair given the market, but it's not cheap. I mean, the average muni golfer, I mean, can for them to get to Bandon and stay there and play every course once. I mean, it's a big ticket, even at what I think is a fair price. And, so it's, you know, golf has always been kind of aspirational, and that's okay. But, I really wish there'd be more investment in the munis. You know, when I see Tiger Woods building these private courses and these super high end housing developments, it's like he should spend the rest of his life building $10 municipal courses in every city in America. I mean, what an incredible legacy! Does he need another $5 or $10 million commission? I mean, it's hard to imagine he does. And for a guy who grew up on ratty public courses, like what? How cool would that be if you just gave back? Said, you know what? I'm gonna buy the land myself. I'm gonna donate my services, and we're gonna just give this community an incredible golf course. And you know, Jack Nicklaus could do that. A lot of guys could do it, and that would do, I think, more to grow the game, to use an old cliche, than almost anything else, because it's pretty grim. I mean, a lot of cities, there might be one or two golf courses, and they're flat, little push up greens, and the people who play them are missing out on the artistry and the beauty of the course to a large degree, because the playing field's so basic. And I would love to see the USGA and the PGA of America, I mean, Augusta National, like, you know, put your money where your mouth is and just build great, super affordable courses, or just fix up the ones that already exist. You know, there's already, you don't even need to get a new piece of land. You could use the existing footprint. Like, cause when you do it, like at, as you know, it's starting to happen when these courses come back online, it's a celebration and everyone loves them and you get so much out of them. And so anyway, that's my little soapbox, but I do think there's, even as I get to benefit from, I get to play these courses, I still feel like there's something fundamentally wrong with the golf world that 99% of golfers don't get to play, you know, really fun golf courses that often.
Yeah. Well, that's a good soapbox, Bjorn. And I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, you've got a window here where if the powers that be, the five families and some of our most, you know, influential individuals decided to make that kind of a move with, you know, municipal and public facilities, it really would fundamentally, you know, change the foundation of the game for a long time, but we'll see. I'm not going to hold my breath, but, you know, it would be cool. Let me ask this, talking about kind of the future of the game. I'd be remiss not to ask you kind of how you feel about the state of golf media and people who are putting words together about the game these days.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's been a tough year for everyone and a lot of industries, but the sports media and the golf media has been hit really hard. You know, certain trends that were already in motion have been exacerbated by Corona, and you know, the dismantling of golfchannel.com, and that's been a bummer to see. I mean, that was a really good website, a lot of talented people. You know, golf week is a lie. You know, it went monthly a while ago. Golf World's been gone for a good long while, but I still miss that. You know, golf magazines, we've gone down to 8 issues a year from 12. So it's tough. I mean, good journalism is not cheap. And it's funny, because when I go, you know, I take my kids to the movies, I'm happy to pay my $12. I understand there's a cost to produce a movie. And when I go to Barnes & Noble, you know, I know I'm gonna have to pay for a book, but people just want journalism to be free. And so The Athletic has helped change that a little bit, but it's still, you know, they've yet to commit to really covering the sport. I mean, they have Brendan Quinn's a talented guy, but he's only out there a handful of times a year. And so even the one model where people are paying for good content, they haven't really embraced golf yet. And so, you know, it's challenging. There's fewer and fewer typists. There's more content creators. And, you know, a lot of the videos and the podcasts and all that, they're really well done. And and I enjoy them like everybody else. But you know, to kind of get lost in a richly reported, well-written story, I mean, that's become more rare. I think the Golfers Journal has done a great job and kind of creating a community and showing the value of a beautiful product, but it is only four times a year. Like it, so it's a challenge. I mean, I kind of wonder what it's going to look like in 10 years. I mean, if there's even going to be any sports writers left. You know, it's more and more, as things become more digital and it's more kind of consumable. A lot of it's being done in-house because, you know, when I go to tournaments, there's more PGAtour.com staffers than there are actual reporters, and they have more resources and they have more access, and the players know that they're going to be taken care of, that essentially those content creators are working for the players. And so it's just a totally different dynamic than, you know, traditional reporters. So it's complicated. I mean, we're hanging on, but it's been a very challenging time.
Well, yeah, it is. And you know, I hold on to faith that there's still a future there. You know, I give you guys a lot of credit. You know, I always enjoy the sort of mix between what you and Bamberger put out. I always love going back and forth between, especially when y'all are both at an event. It's a great, you know, great sandwich of reading. I just always really enjoy that and look forward to those pieces when they come out, and hopefully we'll continue to have a future with words, but you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, I appreciate that. And it's, you know, I don't take myself too seriously. I know that my job is basically to give people something to read while they're on the throne. Like, you know, this is not national security that we're reporting upon or anything like that. But, you know, golf does have an incredible literary tradition, and whether Grantland Rice helped found Augusta National, but, you know, from Herbert Warren Wynne to Dan Jenkins, go on down the list. I mean, there's always been such great writing about the game. And, you know, George Plimpton's small ball theory, the smaller the ball, the better the writing. You know, baseball and golf has always had, you know, really attracted, you know, certain literary dreamers. And so it'll be sad if that sort of fundamental DNA is lost, because the sport really lends itself to reflection and intimacy. And if you don't have people on site with access, then that's just going to disappear. So, you know, I'm not that old, but I'm kind of a dinosaur. I mean, I grew up before cell phones, before the internet, and you know, and all those old timers were still around. I mean, I see Jim Murray in the press room during the West Coast Swing, and I was more starstruck by him than Jack Nicklaus. You know, the writers were my heroes, not the golfers. And so, you know, I hope I can keep doing what I'm doing. I really enjoy the challenge of writing these long pieces, and yeah, and it's something I love doing. And it's nice that there are people out there who still want to read them. But I definitely, I you know, I when I look down the road, it's I wonder how long any of us are going to get to keep doing this, or if we're all just going to be replaced by 25-year-old PGA Tour staffers who are making TikToks. So we'll see. There's a battle going on for the soul of the golf media, and it's not really clear which side's going to win yet.
Well, fingers crossed. Like I said, we'll still have places where a few well-constructed verses can live and thrive and be appreciated. I know you got to jump, but next time I make my way out to Carmel, I'll give you a ring and we can flush it all out a little bit more on the golf course.
Oh, I look forward to it. That's definitely happening. So yeah, let me know. I'm here for sure. So thanks for having me, Jay. This was
Cool,
good
man.
fun.
Yeah, man. Thanks, Alan. Appreciate you, man. And look forward to reading your next
All right,
piece,
take
buddy.
care. Thanks. Bye.
All right. You too. Bye.